नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So, offer you some reflections on how to get out of trouble during the new year. I guess people make all kinds of New Year's resolutions around now. I'm not sure, but one of the main intentions in Buddhist practice is to realize peace, obviously. And peace requires a certain stability of mind. And the peace that the Buddha talks about is quite profound. It's not simply the absence of noise, say in the forest, or the absence of stimulation. It's a kind of peace which is not dependent on circumstance, on sickness or health. It's not dependent on good weather or bad weather, whether you had a good turkey for Christmas or not. It's not dependent on those things that make us happy. So the peace that the Buddha realized was spiritual, profound, whatever way you like to describe that. And when we talk about the Buddhist teachings, as I always say, really, we refer to his recommendations about our social life, the way we live family life, the way we live our life of social relationships, the way we care for the land, and how we care for our families, and so on and so forth, because that the social life that we live is a source of stability if we live it well. It's a source of confusion if we live it in a confused way. And so Buddhism always emphasizes a moral integrity and generosity. These are the two things that the Buddha would teach before he taught meditation. So first thing taught was generosity. Interesting that when the heart is generous, it has space, it's not selfish, it's happy to a certain extent. And a happy mind is a stable mind to some extent, not an excited mind, but a mind which has goodness and contentment. It feels well, doesn't it? When you do something beautiful for someone and you offer something to them in a way that makes them happy and so on, that gives you a certain wellness in the heart. So that kind of stability comes from generosity, a big part of Buddhist practice. And the other in our social life is the capacity to refrain from harming oneself and others. So restraint, moral restraint, restraint on our appetites, a way of accepting the fact that we do get angry and we have greed, hatred, and delusion which run through consciousness, but we don't have to be victims of that, so we can refrain from harming ourselves and others. And those two are really preliminaries, but they're basic to any kind of good life, isn't it? Any kind of good life. So in meditation is practiced without those in place, then it's going to be pretty hard, because there'll be all the memories of regret and remorse, and the heart might be quite selfish. So you find people who maybe like meditation, they can get into a kind of selfish sense of "leave me alone, I'm meditating." It's probably kind of more like a monastic problem. "Leave me alone, I'm trying to get enlightened." And so they have aversion and resent work and so on and so forth. And that's a heart which lacks generosity. But generosity is we would say it's a means. It's a method rather than an end in itself, because there's no end of generosity you can practice and completely burn out. So that's not the goal. The goal isn't to just be in some ridiculously altruistic way, totally generous all the time, and ignore your own needs and ignore your own resources and your own energy. That would be foolish. So we say that generosity is a method. It's not a goal. It's a good way to look at that because we can't always feel generous. Sometimes we just feel, I don't want to give you anything today, which is okay. It's just the human heart gets tired and burnt and it doesn't want to serve, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's not a method for getting enlightened. It's something that comes up naturally, but the method for getting enlightened is to be patient with that. To be patient with meanness and stinginess and aversion and all of that, to not make it a problem, but to also accept it. To accept these are human conditions. They're neither right nor wrong. They just arise according to causes and conditions. And that's the beauty of the Buddhist practice, is that its emphasis on heart is one which accepts all phenomena, whether it be internal or external, accepts them all because they're all part of nature. The most horrible thought I might have and the most altruistic thought I might have, it's still part of nature because it's in consciousness. But he encouraged us, abandon the unwholesome, cultivate the wholesome, so that it can do. So if my mind is inclining towards revenge or jealousy or something like that, I can notice that and just be patient with it. Just be patient with it, don't go that way. But not deny it. So it's not a repressive teaching. It's not a teaching which is coercing one into being something all the time. But generosity is the method. So when you have a chance, when we have opportunity to practice generosity, we do that as much as is reasonable according to our resources. And then also morality, the kind of refraining from harming other beings or harming oneself or just harming the environment or whatever way you want to put that, or just indulging the appetites, that kind of outward energy which is always either harming or indulging all the time. Those are still, they're impulses that we have. We have impulses to harm and we have impulses to indulge, but we don't need to do that. And so restraint is a very, very wholesome quality because there's a kind of power of the mind, isn't it, when you're able to see some appetite that you have, which is maybe not totally moral, but just obsessive or leads to restlessness or whatever, and you say, no, I'm going to moderate that. There's a kind of contentment that comes from that, a kind of strength and stability of mind, because now we're no longer the victim of all our appetites. But that's not to deny that we have appetites. They're natural. Nothing wrong with them. So the kind of middle way path that the Buddha recommended was one between just following our appetites in a compulsive way or trying to repress them. Not to go either way, to see what's appropriate and what's right to do. So this creates a really beautiful stability in the mind and consciousness, our social life. But there are other ways that we gain stability or happiness. One of the ways, if I came across a really nice phrase, the contentment of competence. Isn't that nice? The contentment of competence. When you do something like a craft or bake a cake or play squash or whatever, whatever you like to do, and you train in it, you work at it, and you do it well. And so there's a lovely sense of contentment. And so the Buddha, he recommended to develop a good livelihood, good craft, good way of living in the world where you can use skill, where you can use intelligence, where you can use the gifts that you have and develop them, that there's a certain amount of stability from that. Hopefully a good wage packet too, which is also very stable. But you think about it, when you can do something well, that takes effort, to learn how to do cabinet making or to learn how to cook or to learn how to sew robes. So that's one of the things I notice here is that young monks come and some of them are urban and, the only thing they've learned is video games, I think. And it's very interesting how little kind of broad skills they have because they've never had to, like take the garbage out and shovel the snow, So then they come here and they're like, you kind of, which end of a paintbrush do I hold? Not quite that bad. But then you see them kind of like picking up from the older monks and learning how, how to fix a John Deere lawnmower or build a lighting system for a cootie with solar panels and all that. And you see this lovely, lovely sense of joy in their hearts, competence, competence. And that helps their meditation. It helps their meditation. Because why? Because they've put effort forth, they've learned and they've struggled and they messed it up and they've broken one solar panel or whatever and, did what we do. But then they start to get competence and skill, and then they feel, yeah, I'm all right. And that I'm all right is very important when you meditate, because you can get very self-critical in meditation, because it's tougher than solar panels. It's got more challenges. But if you say, well, I can do that, I can do other things. So there's a kind of stability and happiness, and which is not the same as the happiness of having an ice cream cone. It's pretty short-lived. It's a more, obviously, a more profound kind of that. You can think of other ways socially that we can develop competence, serving, say, learning how to care for someone, that kind of generosity, where you have, I think one of the monks went to visit family, and his grandparents were there. And part of our training here is to that the junior monks take care of the senior monks, so it's a sense of caring for the elders. And this monk said that, he'd never really thought much about that as a layperson. He just saw elderly people, and kind of, wasn't mean-hearted. But here we actually like train junior monks or novices to look out and see what does the elder person need. So he went back and he was with his grandparents, and he had a lot of skill, a lot of skill in looking out for his grandfather and being aware and attentive and where he's walking and how to make sure he doesn't go off the curb and helping him get the key in the door and all manner of things. And his grandfather's very, very grateful, very grateful. And that brings him a lot of happiness, doesn't it? And that's a stability, and that helps the meditation. So our social life is very important, isn't it? That we try to do that as well as we can. But our social life will always be verging on disaster, I think. There'll always be problems. There'll always be disappointments. People will be, you'll do something good and they'll be ungrateful, and all manner of things can happen to us. So these good qualities that we develop, they're the method. They're not the goal. Because if the goal of the spiritual life was some kind of social construct, some kind of perfect family or perfect community or perfect monastery, we'd be searching for lifetimes and we'd never find it, because it doesn't exist. You'll never find a perfect family, perfect partner, perfect abbot, you'll never find that, or a perfect junior monk, a perfect monastery. It just doesn't exist, because it's not in the nature of things. And once we realize that, we're grateful when it's good, we're patient when it's not so good. But we contribute what we can in a skillful and meaningful way. So it's a method. So good family is a method, not an end in itself. Huh? Because whatever, you have a good family, and then someone's just going through some kind of crisis. It's natural. Which family doesn't have a crisis? Every family has a crisis. You name one family that doesn't have a crisis. Natural. I don't wish it on anyone for the new year. But if the family, if like perfect familial harmony all the time, 24/7, were the goal of the spiritual life, that would be a lot of suffering. But if the goal is to contribute to family harmony and as much as you can, and then when it's not good, when it is discordant, then to try to be patient, to try to offer patience and listening skills and so on to the discordant part of life. So family life is a goal, is a method, is a method. Good family life, good relationships, generous living, compassionate living, and so on. So compassion is a method. So that's the aspect of the Buddhist teaching which deals with the conventional, what we call the conventional world, and my family and my situation in life. And then the Buddha tries to suggest another way of looking at our life experience, and that's as what we call stream of consciousness, which I always talk about. So this is a different way of looking at your life. It's a way of looking at moment by moment how events come and go, come and go, come and go, come and go, as thoughts, as feelings, as emotions, as memories, as bodily sensations, as tastes, as sounds, as smells, odors, and so on and so forth. And that's the way. What we try to do is we try to disengage from the storyline, from the particular narrative that we're going on in, or we try to have. Let's say we live in our narrative. We all have a narrative. I live the Viradhamma narrative, which is going very well, I'm happy to say, for now, maybe not tomorrow, and that's the narrative I live in. But also, there's a possibility of having a kind of background awareness, which we all have, of I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling happy, my knee hurts, I wish this would end, I wish this would go on, I don't like her, I don't like him, I like him, I don't like this, they should have put more. That whole commentary in the mind, the bodily feelings we have, all the inputs that come to us, that we're noticing and watching as just a stream of events. Now that's what we call the reflective mind. If we were just in the events of our lives, then we would be pretty much reactive, but we wouldn't be reflected. And the reflection is like stepping back. So not only can I feel, let's say, annoyed at someone because they are behaving in a way I don't like, but I can also notice that I'm annoyed, can't I? And that's the saving grace. If I couldn't notice that I'm annoyed, I'd be the victim of annoyance. There'd be no freedom, right? So the saving grace is that we can be aware, we can function in life, but we can also be aware of how we're functioning, right? Otherwise, we'd be in a madhouse. So that capacity is what we mean by awareness. So in the meditation, I was suggesting notice that the eyes are in awareness. Notice that sound is in awareness. Notice the bodily feelings are in awareness. See that awareness, perceive awareness as something quite large, limitless. Now when you start to do that, then as happiness and unhappiness comes through you, you begin to see that happiness and unhappiness are dependently originated. I'm happy because my knees are good and my stomach is good and it's comfortable right now. And then my knees go out, or my stomach misbehaves, or it gets cold, and then I'm unhappy. Happiness, unhappiness, coming and going according to cause and conditions. But notice the awareness contains that. Awareness knows that because this person said that to me, I feel upset. And when the other person complimented me, I feel I really like that person. I can see, oh yeah, I see that's dependent. But the awareness is not the same. It's not like a sound or a sight or an emotional feeling. It has its own life, and it's not that life. The life of awareness is not dependent on hot or cold. You can get as hot as you want, right? And you can be aware of it, but you can't always be hot. You can get as cold as you want. You can be aware of it, but you can't always be cold. And so this awareness is something that the Buddha said was, to say the least, very interesting. And very important to develop the capacity to not only live a good life, but to be aware of our inner world. And the way we practice that in meditation is that we learn how to stabilize the mind and objects of meditation, which we just did, the breath, and so on. But that in itself is not the end either, that's the means, because even though you stabilize your mind and the breath, and maybe you can make your mind peaceful and get skillful that way, when you go back into ordinary life, your buttons still get pressed. You still get upset and angry. So there's more work. It's not simply tranquilizing the mind in some kind of skillful way. That is a necessary, we would say it's a necessary part of Buddhist practice, but it's still a method, not an end. And this is where people sometimes get a bit confused about Buddhism, because they sometimes can get very good at calming the mind. And then they think they've got it, and then something happens, their posture goes, or they get the flu or whatever, or someone says something to them, and they lose that peace. And they think, well, I want to get that peace back. But that very peace is still constructed. It's still dependent. And the Buddhist peace is independent. It's not dependent. And the way we realize that peace is much more subtle. And the way we realize that peace is taking up a different kind of meditation. And that's the meditation of noticing change. And that's very hard to do, and yes, very simple. We try to bring our mind into presence, try to sustain mind presence, and we try to sustain that presence and stabilize the mind by noticing that which begins ends, that hot and cold begin and end, that like and dislike begin and end. We see this movement, but we are no longer the movement. And sustaining that, we call that anicca sanya, or characteristic meditation. That meditation is not dependent on the particular experience you're having. You can feel great, or you can feel absolutely crappy. And you can know, great arose, passed away, crappy arose, passed away, came and went. And that kind of meditation is then what we call vipassana meditation, or insight meditation. It's not trying to stabilize the mind in an object by excluding other objects, not doing that. That's skillful, but here it's not doing that, it's letting go of all objects and just being the witness or knowing change. Now if you can do that for long periods of time, you begin to discover a stability which takes you inward to a deeper and deeper silence. A silence now which it doesn't really care whether it's hot or cold. The body cares. You have to take care of the body. I'm not suggesting you go out and lie in the mud and get nice and cold and watch that kind of awareness, because that would be stupid. There's still relative truth. But the capacity, you know, like in a meditation, to feel it's not going well, that very feeling of it not going well is an object. That mood is an object. And what's very difficult to do is to notice a mood of the mind. Like, let's say if I feel annoyed at a sound outside, it's very hard to notice annoyance and realize it's not the sound. Right? Annoyance is not the sound, right? But when something annoys me, I usually connect, well, it's that thing. And I don't know how to isolate the mood of the mind. I get caught in the sound. And functionally, I have to, maybe, like if I hear a gas tank explodes, I need to do something about that. There is a connection. I'm not saying they're not connected. But one of the things we try to do in flow of consciousness, noticing the changing nature of things, is like if I'm really greedy for something, I really want something, not to deny the wanting, but just to isolate that wanting. What does wanting really feel like, irrespective of the thing I want? Or if I'm annoyed or hate someone, hate myself even, whatever, it doesn't matter who you hate, hate is hate, to isolate hatred as an object. Now that's a kind of very powerful meditation, because we become the subject of mood so quickly. And that's the very problem. We believe we are these moods, and we just get thrown around back and forth with these moods. We feel inspired, and life is great, or that's not working, we feel depressed, it's not working, and so we become the moods. But all of us also have certain moods where we don't become the moods. We know them, don't we? We know that's a mood, and we don't grasp them, and that's what we call non-attachment. So you may be like a child does something, and it's a childish thing. You don't make a problem out of it. It's what kids do. You might feel annoyed, but you don't go there. And that's the kind of freedom within the mood itself. But some moods really drive us. They really obsess us, and we become strong sense of self, don't we? And those are the moods we have to isolate. The moods where there is a strong sense of self-identity, that what we have to do is notice that mood as an object of mind, not become the subject. And that's a difficult task. That's a very, very difficult task. Loneliness or fear or resentment or jealousy or the different very powerful emotions create a sense of a self. And that sense of a self, all that is thought. That's all it is. As soon as you stop thinking, it's not there. It's just soap bubble. But we believe it. We believe it so very, very strongly. So being able to be aware of the mood of the mind is something that arises and changes is part of the craft of meditation. And as we see that, what happens is the moods no longer create a self. They have an energy, but what becomes more powerful is the awareness of change. And the awareness of change begins to dominate, begins to have power, begins to be a place that is a true refuge and takes us inwards to a deep, deep silence. The nature of these moods and habits that we have, they can, like, they're what we call karma, aren't they? Like, they can really be persistent. You can be constantly triggered into moods of doubt, maybe. It's constantly, mind's just triggered into doubt, constantly. Some people just doubt all the time. Or constant cynicism, or constant criticism, or constant self-doubt. And these are what we call karma. These are powerful forces. They're not just things that you kind of say, oh, I got irritated, and then I saw it and left, and it's not that easy. I wish it was. These are powerful forces we're dealing with. And what we're trying to see them as objects. A mood of anger is an object. And just to be able to do that empowers awareness rather than empowering a sense of self. The attachment to these things empowers a sense of self, and it's endless. It's absolutely endless. It goes on and on and on and on. Never really ends. So the meditations we do, what we try to do is disempower attachment. And one way of looking at attachment is that it's a constant preoccupation. Constant preoccupation with your moods, constant preoccupation with thought, with ideas. It's just the mind is always preoccupied with an object. And by objects, I mean sights and sounds, tastes, memories, emotions, and all the rest of it. Constantly preoccupied. And as long as the attention is preoccupied with all that stuff, you can't see anything new. You only see the old, right? And as long as you're only seeing the old, that's all you'll have. So non-preoccupation, what would that be? Well, that you notice the mood, but don't get preoccupied with it. It's not saying that mood's bad or wrong. It's just don't preoccupy with it. So you have some, like if I have some self-doubt, and I I don't know, am I getting in here? Did I do that wrong? Oh, I shouldn't have said that to that person. Oh, but they said that to me. That's preoccupation, right? And then you notice, this is doubt. And as soon as you say, you just label it doubt. That's what doubt feels like. Don't try to solve it. Just don't be preoccupied with it. And what happens if you do that? You become available. You're watchful, and you're available. You're available for what? Well, don't worry about it. Because if you're looking for something, the only thing you'll find is what you know already. Objects of mind. And this is what desire does. Desire is always looking for things, recreating experiences that you had, the sweetness of life and so on. But the liberation of the heart is not done through following desire. It's done through observing desire. And when you observe desire, like where does desire take you? Desire takes you to objects. I want this, I want that, I don't want this, I don't want that. But when you observe desire, you're no longer preoccupied with objects. You just know desires come up. Well, it's not so easy. Not so easy. But that's the method, is to observe desire rather than believe in its the siren songs of desire. You know, the melodies of desire. Come to me. You'll be happy. There's a, you know, we talk about the five khandhas. The five khandhas is the way we talk about the sense experience. So there's the body, the feelings of like and dislike, perceptions, constructs that we have, mental formations, and the different sense doors that we have. And there's an image in the text where a person sees a house with four doors and a window, and he hears the voice, come to me, come here. And he goes way, way off in the distance, come here, So the person starts to run towards this house, to this building across the field, running, running, come closer. And the voice gets louder and louder and louder. Knocks on the door, opens the door, and someone shoots him. That's the five khandhas. The objects are mine. They're just grabbing your attention and making a fool out of you. That's what they're doing, right? Okay, this is really good. Oh, we get shot. So you have to be a Buddhist to appreciate that. But non-preoccupation is not denying that we are sense beings, but realizing that sense experience is okay, and I like comfort, and I like milk in my coffee, and so on and so forth. I'm natural, but that's not the spiritual goal, right? And seeing that the spiritual goal is not an object that you're just pursuing. It's the knowing of objects changing, and trusting in that takes you to deep peace. But desire doesn't trust that. Desire says, sugar, whatever it says, give me more, give me whatever, and it shoots you every time. Now, repression would be denying the beauty of sense experience. You're not denying that, but just seeing that's limited, that the beauty is limited, comfort is limited. But there, the Buddha's teaching says there is the unlimited, the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unborn, the deathless, Nibbana, the island, the refuge, and peace. So where does that peace lie? Does it lie in something that changes? It can't, logically. If something has the nature to change, it can't be peaceful, because it's going to slip out of your fingers. So peace cannot be an object that changes, but it is the knowing of change. Just going to reverse it a bit, that's all. Piece of cake. You just reverse it a bit. Huh? So when you feel unfulfilled desire, it's not wrong to pursue that, but to observe unfulfilled desire as an object of mind is a particular strength. And when you can do that, not hurt yourself, not hurt anyone else, and watch unfulfilled desire, watch it arise, watch it stay for a while, and watch it cease. In that cessation, you realize a peace which is more profound, because it's not dependent on getting what you want. And that's what Nibbana is defined as. It's the cessation of getting what you want. Not the rejection of it, not the denial of it, not some absolute bed of nails that you have to sleep on for the rest of your life, right? But rather know that the awareness can know unfulfilled desire, can watch it, can be patient with it, and it can cease. And in that cessation, you realize, wow, I'm peaceful and I didn't get what I want. Or I'm peaceful and I got what I didn't want. Now that's cool. That's very, very nice. And that gives you a kind of confidence. And it's a skill, isn't it? It's a skill that you do. We all, as adults, we do that. We give things up, don't we? We give things up. We forego short-term desire for long-term freedom, don't we? We've all done that. What is that? Where we've studied, or you've sat through a meditation which is unpleasant, or been in a relationship which is difficult and then kept with it, or whatever it is. We've given up short-term desire for long-term peace. And that's what the Buddha's pointing to, that yeah, sure, there are short-term gains in following the desire mind, and it's not wrong. But at some point, he's saying, if you're always pursuing objects, you're looking in the wrong place. You're going to get shot. So then you turn back and say, so what is it? What is unconditioned? What is uncreated? What is not born? What does not die? What is peaceful? You kind of ask yourself those kinds of questions. And what that does, what's not changing? So you think, if there's the changing, what is there anything that's not changing? What's unchanging? If you ask that question to yourself, if you try to figure it out, you'll just be thinking, which is changing. But what's unchanging, your mind will not go towards that which is changing. What's unchanging? Well, what is it? And you come back to awareness. Awareness of change is unchanging. You kind of begin to trust in that. So that's what we call vipassana meditation. So the object meditation, where we take an object and we calm the mind and stabilize the mind like we do with the breath, that we call samatha practice. And then the other, where we look at change and we abide as a witness to change. Not change as a kind of Buddhist agreement. I keep emphasizing this the last 2 months. It's not that you're just agreeing, yeah, things change. No, you're doing it. You're doing a perception. You know, you're doing a perception. You're actually practicing a perception. Like, I can practice a perception that it's too cold, it's too cold, it's too cold. That's a perception. No sun, no sun, no sun. That's a perception. Or it's lovely, it's lovely, it's lovely. That's a perception. You know, whatever way you want to translate it, right? So we use perceptions. But usually we don't use them, well, maybe not usually, but what the Buddhist teaching is saying, use the perception of change as your constant mantra, as your constant method of observing the way things are. Just changing. Ajahn Chah's, it's uncertain. But constantly, right? Not just like, oh, the day ended, it has changed. Once in every 24 hours? No, that's not practice, that's just agreement. This is nature. This is practice, you're doing practice. So you're feeling really annoyed at someone, uncertain. You really like someone, uncertain. Right? You're feeling jealous, uncertain. And each time you do uncertain on all those moods of mind, you're no longer that mood. You have to have some distance to do that. You'd say if you're really, really jealous of someone, they get the wage, they get the raise, and you don't, or whatever, and you've worked harder and all the rest of it, and you feel this incredible rush of jealousy, right? It's not fair, damn it! And everyone agrees with you, let's say, which is even better. Everyone's juicing you up to feel irate and indignant, and you go for it, right? And everyone will agree with you, fine. But you're born into that. You become indignant. Which is all right if you want to. But if you say this indignance is uncertain, and that's a strength, that's a strength. It's hard to do because your desire mind wants to kill the boss and the person who got more money than you. Right? That's your desire mind because you should have had, that's the desire mind. That's the sense of self. But, and if you have the strength of mind to say uncertain without coming up, that's good practice. Right? And then it comes up again, oh, it's not fair. Uncertain. Yeah, but I were uncertain. That's the practice. You just keep doing it, you keep doing it. And each time you do it, you are not that mood. That mood is an object. You might have to do it like for 2 days. Just that, it doesn't, this is uncertain that it ends. No, if it has power, if it has karma, if you invested a lot in a situation, it'll come up a lot. So you have to really hammer away at it. Uncertain. Yeah, but it's not fair. Uncertain. And each time you do that, that's non-grasping. Or, say non-preoccupation. You're available again, and then you become unavailable through attachment. Oh, not fair. The world is not fair. Preoccupied, and then non-preoccupation. You keep lifting your mind away from it. So it's not like preoccupying yourself, like saying, "Oh, I shouldn't feel jealousy. I should really like this person. I should practice mudita." That's another preoccupation. Same thing, right? You just keep going. You just preoccupy. Don't preoccupy, just know, boy, this is terrible. This is what terrible feels like. You're not preoccupied. You're watchful and available. Maintain those for a year. Make that your determination for 19, what are we, 1990? No, we're not 19, we're two, I'm off a bit. 2015, 2015. Maintain as that as your determination. Watchful, available, and I reckon you'll be happy. Okay? I'll leave that for your reflection.
Ankhamayam dhamma tathāya sātukāraṁ